This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Slow Village provides a community for people who are aging in their own homes.
It's really been wonderful to see the connections that have formed among the members and the volunteers and friendships.
Also, Lumina Alliance supports and empowers local survivors of sexual assault and intimate partner violence. We'll hear from CEO Jennifer Adams.
The skills that are being utilized at Lumina Alliance are all about being able to be present with somebody who's in trauma, in pain, and we have to be whole and healthy in order to do that.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 11th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. Let's start with a look at sea otters. Hunted to near extinction, southern sea otters have been more common again on the Central Coast. New research from Elkhorn Slough in Monterey County near Moss Landing found that having otters in the salt marsh there is having a stabilizing effect on the ecosystem. Contributor Beth Thornton toured the area with a volunteer scientist.
In the early morning hours, I set out on a boat with Ron Eby. I asked him to introduce himself and talk about his volunteer work with southern sea otters in Elkhorn Slough.
There it is. See right there by the top?
My name is Ron Eby. I'm a volunteer with Elkhorn Slough Reserve. I spend a lot of time here in my what I call my happy place, Elkhorn Slough. My first volunteering here came with an organization called Team Ocean and Baynet. And that's a NOAA-sponsored program that is designed to prevent disturbances to marine mammals. We have a lot of kayakers that come here, often over 100 on the weekends, and they don't know that they have to stay away from the otters to not disturb them. They come out with their cameras, they want to get pictures. And so the idea was to have people on kayaks that are out here that would see them, catch them before they got to the otters, and explain to them the need to keep a distance to not disturb the otters. That was what first got me started with Team Ocean and volunteering here at Elkhorn Slough. And that led to volunteering with the Elkhorn Slough Reserve, which was fantastic because they're maintaining all of this area, do so much work here. But the one thing that happened, part of the training that we got from both the aquarium and from Team Ocean, was that southern sea otters don't haul out. That was one of the distinguishing factors between the northern sea otters and the southern sea otters.
When an otter hauls out, it means they get out of the water. It's a chance to rest and warm up.
But what we noticed was we saw scat and footprints on the beach in the harbor where we were earlier. And so we knew that they were going out there sometimes, but we didn't see them during the day. So we started coming at night, and we found that they were hauling out in some pretty good numbers.
And so you said that was in the 90s. I know there were a small number of otters that survived up in Big Sur.
Right.
And then it wasn't again until the 80s or 90s that they really started repopulating in California. Is that correct?
Right. So that small population, they estimated, was about 50. It was kept pretty quiet because they didn't want the remaining few that were left to get hunted. But they gradually began expanding, came up the coast, got into the Monterey Bay area, and that was in the kelp beds. And that's why so many of the studies were done about otters and the trophic cascade in the kelp beds, where they go down and get the urchins, keep the urchin population under control. But gradually they expanded, and a few came up here into Elkhorn Slough in the early 80s, but not in any numbers of significance. It wasn't until the mid-90s that they really began coming in here, and then their population, once they got used to this. So this is a totally different area than off the coast. Much easier, but they had to learn how to live here. So instead of getting abalone and urchins, here they get a lot of clams that are easily gotten to, and a lot of crabs. So that's what draw them here. And once they got used to that and learned that, and the mothers have their pups. Remember, a female otter has one pup every year. So you get a few otters in here, and they have their pups, and the numbers begin expanding pretty quickly. About 120 here in Elkhorn Slough.
And 3,000 in California?
Yes.
Okay.
It's 3,000 in California.
And 120 of them are here. Okay. I could see why they want to live here. The water is just glassy. They're floating about. Yes. Talk a little bit about the crabs and what's going on right here at the on the banks of Elkhorn Slough. And I can see that we're being watched very closely.
Yes, the otters are curious, especially here in this area. They're not used to seeing a boat. We're in our boat here alongside the shore, so it's just checking us out. So there are two things with the otters and crabs here at Elkhorn Slough. The first study that was done by Brent Hughes was otters and eelgrass. And what eventually we were able to show was that sea otters, by keeping the crab population in the eelgrass under control, fewer crabs meant that there were more grazers that were able to go up and down the eelgrass, keep the eelgrass clean, and therefore the eelgrass flourished. So what we found was, because otters were here, the eelgrass was flourishing, and we could track the number of otters that had come and the growth of the eelgrass. That was a major breakthrough, and that led to other things that we had noticed, and one of which is like all of these crab holes that you see here along the mud bank.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with volunteer Ron Eby at Elkhorn Slough. New research from a team of scientists, including Kat Beheshti from UC Santa Barbara, found that the presence of otters helped to stabilize the salt marsh because they eat the crabs that burrow into the creek banks.
And so what Brent did in working with Kat Beheshti, checked for the impact that the crabs and the otters were having on the pickleweed. The pickleweed is the main plant that we have here that holds the banks in control. It's believed that the otters are actually helping the pickleweed by keeping all those shore crabs afraid of them, at least, and eating so many. And you have to remember, an otter weighs about 60 pounds, but it eats about a quarter of its weight every day. So 120 otters eating a quarter of their weight every day, that's a lot of crabs.
Handfuls and handfuls.
Yes, a quarter of their weight.
And they literally eat the whole thing. They don't take off the shell or anything.
Yes, and that's one of the nice things. One of the things that they did, and we had done on earlier experiments, was you can collect the crab scat and screen it out, and you can identify just by the tiny tips of their legs what type of crab it is. So that's how Brett was able to know that the otters were eating the shore crabs.
Because you have a committed team of volunteers. Tell me about your team and how often people are out here observing.
The team is about 24 people, and they're all retired scientists from various fields and stuff, so they bring lots of experience. They've been able to really develop a nice program. We come out twice a month, and we do it on consecutive weeks because with the tidal cycles, that way we get to see otters under various conditions. And every half an hour, we note all the otters that are in each of the areas. We have 14 different areas that we are monitoring. We'd like to have two people at most of the places to monitor, and they all have telescopes.
Say something about the importance of volunteer scientists.
It works because we coordinate with each other. So what we do, as community scientists, we're open to sharing all of our data. It's available to everybody, and we willingly share it. Scientists have problems. One, they've got to get budgets. So they have to get their money to do the projects. In order to do that, they have to have an hypothesis, and they have to get that grant funding. Then they have to hire people to do the work, and then they have to manage the budget, and then they have to do all the statistics and all the hard work. We have the good part. We get to come out. We do the observations. We're free, essentially. So we get to do all that and have all the fun.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking with Ron Eby, a volunteer at Elkhorn Slough. Elkhorn Slough is home to many plants, birds, and marine mammals. So I asked Ron why he's most interested in otters.
It's their intelligence. It's their intelligence. Otters are extremely important. Like we saw the otter just spy hopping, looking at us as we're here. He's not used to seeing this boat against the shore like this, so he's checking it out. Another thing I really admire about them is the mothers and their dedication to their pups. A sea otter has one pup a year, so when she has that pup, she ends up nursing that for 6 months. And they are just so dedicated, it's unbelievable. One of the sad things to see, especially the first pup that a female otter has, it often doesn't make it. But that mother will hang on to that pup, even though it's dead, for days, sometimes even weeks, just hanging on to it. They're that dedicated to it to try to take care of it. So that is another thing that impresses me about the otters. Their activity, they're always busy. You know, we talk about disturbing them, but a lot of times they disturb each other. They play a lot. You can see their playfulness. They'll jump out of the water, totally out of the water, chasing each other, playing around. Sometimes they're mischievous, and one will come into a group that's just resting, and they'll go around and they'll sniff every one of them and disturb them and stuff. So lots of fun to just watch them with all their activity. They're always very active.
And they live in community.
Yes, they get together in rafts, we call it. So
a raft of otters.
Right. So
what a treat to be out here. Thank you.
Everybody should have a chance to enjoy nature like I have. It's just wonderful.
That was Ron Eby at Elkhorn Slough. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Beth Thornton.
You'll find more information and photos from Elkhorn Slough on the KCBX website. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, the nonprofit story.
This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host. Today, I'm so excited to have with me here Carrie Sheets and Randy Murray. They are volunteers of a nonprofit called Slough Village. Welcome to the program.
Nice to see you.
Nice to be here.
Explain to us about Slough Village.
Well, Slough Village is actually a very vibrant community of people who are working together to support adults who want to remain in their own homes as they age. And we do that by offering services through vetted volunteers. Mm-hmm. And a big part of it is the social part of that because, you know, it helps with people who feel isolated. It's one thing to stay in your own home, but it may be that, you know, everybody else moves away in your neighborhood that you knew or moves to assisted living. So it's a way of making a whole new group of friends as well.
It's a part of the Village movement that began in Beacon Hill, Massachusetts. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's really a unique story that started this whole movement. A group of people who lived in the Beacon Hills neighborhood of Massachusetts, which I've heard is a beautiful little neighborhood, they wanted to stay there and age there, but they realized they were going to need some help to do that. But being a multi-generational neighborhood, their neighbors who were younger were like, well, we don't want these people to move away to assisted living or to live with their kids. We want to make this work. And so, long story short, the first village started, and they were a group of people who were like-minded about the way they wanted to live, what they wanted to do, and remain engaged in their community.
Mm-hmm. You used to be the executive director of Slough Village here,
yes,
too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it actually a designated area where houses are there? Are people in their own homes? Or how does it work?
People are in their own homes, mm-hmm, and that's where they're choosing to live. Now, we do even have some members who have gone to independent living, but they're still members because they realize they would like more rides than they can get maybe on the shuttle, and they have already been used to going to our social events, and they want to continue doing that.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you bring people together?
Well, we have a coffee hour a couple times a month on the first and third Wednesdays. We have a luncheon on the second Monday, and then there are occasional functions like a gratitude gathering and a picnic in the summertime. Mm-hmm. I just came from one of those coffee hours this morning. There were over 20 people there. Mm-hmm. It was a session reviewing Slough Village. We have about 128 members now and volunteers, mm-hmm, and they're all over the county, mm-hmm, people living in their own homes, dedicated to staying in their own homes. I have a regular lady that I visit every week to do her grocery shopping, and because she's arthritic, helping her make her bed. And she is determined to be in that house. She still does her own taxes and tells me that if anything ever happens to her when I'm there, that I am not to call 911. Mm-hmm. I'm to call her son. She doesn't want to go into the system. She wants to be at home the whole time. She's in her 90s now. She did a hot air balloon ride when she was on her 80th birthday. So I love this volunteer work because it allows me to get the stories of so many interesting smart people. Mm-hmm. I am a storyteller myself. I was a journalism major, so mm-hmm. I've told some of these stories. One of the other topics that we talked about in this morning's coffee was this epidemic of loneliness. And mm-hmm. part of the social aspect of Slo Village is bringing people together for these programs, making sure that nobody is lonely.
This sounds very intriguing, working with people actually staying in their physical homes, but yet having a community that yes. they're a part of.
And that's, we refer to it as a community.
A community, yeah. yes.
It's so, a village community.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that you're telling people to come to the village area, do you have a community center that you meet in, or how does that happen?
No, we don't. We do have an office, and mm-hmm. That's where the board has their meetings, and that say it's the UCC Church on Los Osos Valley Road, mm-hmm. and that's also where the coffee is held, so that makes it convenient. And mm-hmm. We're hoping actually to expand the activities once we get the new executive director on board, which we're working to do very quickly. So we may bring movie night back, which we did. We even managed to do it during the pandemic. People would watch a movie in their homes and then get on Zoom and talk about it.
Oh, so. That sounds yeah. like fun. So yeah. you can always communicate with someone and know that there's a friend there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do people get involved with you if they're interested in being a part of Slo Village?
Well, the easiest way to do it is to go to our website, slovillage.org. There's a volunteer application on the website. You can also find out more about becoming a member. It does cost to become a member. It's $500 a year for a single, $750 a year for a couple. Mm-hmm. We do have subsidized memberships because we know not everyone can afford it. And we also have a social membership, which is, mm-hmm. you know, actually more of a way to just support the village at $250 a year. You can come to all our social events, have access to the membership directory and our vetted list of professional vendors that we use.
You can connect people with different services that they need so they're not out there searching on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the volunteers have a variety of talents, as you might imagine. Mine is limited. I mostly take people to appointments.
That's
doctor's
important.
Appointments or grocery store and so mm-hmm. forth. I'm transportation. A lot of our requests are for transportation. Many of our members have had to give up driving, mm-hmm. and so we try to serve them. They log their needs, and we go in and look at those, and if we have the time in our schedule that week, we sign up and mm-hmm. call them and pick them up and take them where they need to go and take them back home again. But there are other volunteers who are computer literate way beyond my ability, or they're cabinet makers. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of talents out there among the volunteers. So we usually, among the volunteers, find people to help our members when we can't, and we guide them to a vetted supplier.
And so have these suppliers contacted Slo Village and offered their services, or have you contacted a list of professionals, or both, or
both,
what?
Both. Both. Mm-hmm. We mm-hmm. have an application, again, on our website for outside services that if they want to be on our list, what they have to do. So, mm-hmm. but often it's word of mouth, and then we'll go back and we'll kind of check, you know, does this electrician have his license, and mm-hmm. we'll do all the background check. And same with our volunteers. We have quite a process that we've developed for vetting them with a background check and training and other mm-hmm. things like that to make sure that they're the right fit.
Right, exactly, mm-hmm. before you send them to someone's home.
Right.
When people express an interest, we have a committee that visits with them in their home, and one of the parts of that visit is to look at the architecture of their home to see if there are hazards that might be eliminated, and we have some people very capable of seeing problems in the home and recommending repairs and that sort of thing.
That's great. Now, is there an age requirement to join?
We actually lowered the age requirement to 50 and over.
Wonderful.
Because we found there's been situations where mm-hmm. somebody just gets an illness mm-hmm. or gets in an accident or something where they just really need the services mm-hmm. at a younger age, at 50.
So these are people that are living by themselves or maybe with a partner or a spouse, as opposed to living in a family situation.
Mm-hmm. One of those younger people, I think younger, it's hard for me to tell sometimes, was caught in an avalanche and buried to the waist. He and a companion had to fight their way out. This was in Colorado some years ago.
My goodness.
And she has some back problems as a result of that now, but that was a pretty dramatic story. She's probably not one of the older people. She's one of the younger people in our group.
Mm-hmm.
She had an interesting life experience, and so many of these people do have interesting life experiences. We have a woman that swam laps for years and had to give that up and had to give driving up, and she's still in the water in water therapy. She's still keeping it going. Mm-hmm. And we have a couple who have lost their sight, and one is helping the other. The one that's been sightless longer is teaching the person who just lost his sight recently to use an iPhone to be able to do things like calling up an Uber and being independent in terms of moving around.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some amazing stories. Everybody has a story, and some of them are pretty dramatic.
If you're just joining us, this is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, and this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm speaking with Karen Sheets and Randy Murray, who are volunteers with Slow Village here in San Luis Obispo County. So I'm wondering, do you collaborate with any other nonprofits to get extra services or help, or how does that work?
We do. We like to think of ourselves as experts in all the services that any older adult might need throughout the county. We're connected with Hospice Slow. Wilshire Community is a supporter. We know we have somebody going to the Agency for Aging meetings, so we try to be very connected and always stay on top of what the services are that are available. Even rideshare, that we had somebody come in and talk to our coffee group about all the transportation services and how they've been tweaked so that seniors can use them more easily. And also Alzheimer's organization. That would be one, too.
Mm-hmm. So you're connecting people instead of being on their own and trying to figure this out. You are there to help people find what they need.
Absolutely. And if, you know, if we're not pushing that out in a coffee, certainly a member could call up and say, hey, I need help with this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that just happened. Speaking of the couple who are blind or going blind, we have a third member of the village who is losing her sight. And so we've connected the three of them so that they can, the two that are a little more experienced can be helping this new woman who's also just going through the mental grief of, wow, I am going to be blind sooner than I ever imagined. So it's really been wonderful to see the connections that have formed among the members and the volunteers and friendships.
Yeah.
So
you don't have to be alone in this.
Right. And we say this often, but we volunteers feel like we're getting the best end of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we
I
just feel always so much gratitude. So
you mentioned the coffee a couple of times.
First and third Wednesdays we gather. Sometimes we have a program. Carrie's husband is very good at doing, 10 minutes of science, but it's really
moments of science, he calls them.
That sounds like
moment,
fun.
A moment of silence.
But it's much more than a moment.
Uh-huh.
And recently, he did one on the Webb Space Telescope that I knew very little about.
Mm-hmm.
It was absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. We went for probably an hour and 15 minutes on that, and he's shows slides, and he also did one on electric vehicles.
Wow.
So he keeps us kind of up to date. I also wanted to mention that there's some humor in the group. As I say, the luncheon is, I think, the second Monday of every month, and we've had difficulty finding a venue that's quiet enough to do this, and we're over at IHOP now in a back room, and it's working out pretty well. And I was sitting across from a woman in her early 90s and a retired physician who was older than that, somewhere else in the 90s. And she remarked that, oh, yeah, we were born when Grover Cleveland was president. And, you know, for about 2 seconds, I bought into that, and then I realized Grover Cleveland was president back in the 1800s, you know, the late 1800s. They have not lost their sense of humor. They're just wonderful, warm people with all kinds of stories to tell.
People have so much knowledge they're taking with them. And many times in our society, people are put aside at a certain age when really they are the wisdom carriers of our society.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Randy's done a wonderful job. You can find the stories he's written about various members on our website. But he's done a wonderful job of carrying on that legacy. These stories that we each think, oh, I don't have a story. And we all have a story.
That is amazing. Well, how can people connect with you? How can they learn more?
Again, calling the office, getting more information online, slowvillage.org. The office is 805-242-6440. If you know somebody who's a member or volunteer, ask more about it. Call the office and ask for a brochure to be mailed to you.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you're saying that people get connected with each other. Do you also help people learn different things like technology? I mean, we're a technology society now, and a lot of times it can just go over your head.
We do, and we find many of these members hungry for that information. They're not Luddites. They're embracing all that's new and are eager to learn. So it's fun to watch that. They're rich in life experience. They're rich in education, thoughtful, mm-hmm. still giving. Mm-hmm. They're still out there doing their own volunteer work in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Is there a limit to how many people you can have in the village, or are you still taking people in?
No, and I do want to say we really would love to have volunteers reach out to us, because that is always the limiting factor in adding more members. Mm-hmm. We always want to make sure we have enough volunteers, especially lately are looking for more volunteers, so contact our office and find out what you need to do, because we'd love to have people who want to help others and make a difference with their life.
So tell us, what would a volunteer do?
Well, they could drive somebody to an appointment. They could help maybe somebody with yard work, simple yard work. Planting flowers. Mm-hmm. Randy does some household items, like he explained, mm-hmm. for one woman. Grocery shopping is something we often do. I do visitations of people who are just home by themselves. Mm. I call them up every week, and then I'll try to visit them a couple times a month. So let's see what else. Oh, handyman services are a big thing. Mm-hmm. And especially for widows who never had to maybe manage that kind of thing before. I've found that, you know, my husband's very handy, and he's gone into some people's homes and fixed their garage door opener when they thought they were going to have to get a new one. So sometimes, you know, that is a good service we can provide, is we can at least check to see, do you really need that professional to fix whatever, like a plumber or whatever. We've got some really talented handymen.
That's persons. Huge. That is huge when you can help people get things fixed without having to get a bill for it. Mm-hmm. So how many members do you have about now?
I think we have about 60 members.
Well, the number 50. With volunteers I heard today was about 128.
That's great.
That includes the volunteers and members. Mm-hmm. And I'm a social member as well as a volunteer. In other words, I, it's one of my charities that I donate to, and I, therefore I become a social member, and I'm allowed to go and hang out at the coffee hours.
This has been a wonderful conversation on Slow Village in San Luis Obispo County. I was speaking with Carrie Sheets and Randy Murray, volunteers who are dedicated to helping those in our community to stay in their homes as they age. Thank you so much for being here today, Carrie.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you. And Randy?
Thank you, Dr. Mears.
Thank you so much. This is the Nonprofit Story.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, Working Lunch.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jim D'Antona, CEO for the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and your host today, and this is the Working Lunch. The Slow Chamber has formed a direct partnership with KCBX to bring you these working lunch discussions. Each month, we will sit down and meet with a member of our community to talk about doing business on the Central Coast. We will be bringing you conversations with folks who are doing interesting things and impacting the business community that help them meet the challenges of our current business environment. We hope you will join us for these conversations every month on KCBX's Issues and Ideas. Today, I'm so pleased to be sitting down with Jennifer Adams. Jennifer Adams is the Chief Executive Officer for Lumina Alliance. Lumina Alliance is a nonprofit organization dedicated to creating a community that is free from sexual and intimate partner violence. Hello, Jennifer. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me, and please call me Jenny.
Ah, wonderful. I will do that. For our audience, Lumina Alliance is for people who have been subject to sexual and intimate partner violence. Lumina has advocate services, people who are trained to help survivors with medical exams, law enforcement interviews, and court appearances. Lumina also provides emergency and transitional shelters, education, therapy, and public policy work to support survivors of these terrible situations. So, Jenny, there might be people listening who aren't familiar with Lumina Alliance, but I think people will know the former organizations that have evolved into Lumina Alliance. Can you give us a rundown to the origins of Lumina Alliance?
Yes, it's a long history with lots of names, and it actually also highlights my own history in this work because I started in 1999 at the Rape Crisis Center. And so that was the organization that just served victims of sexual assault. From there, we changed our name to the SARP Center, the Sexual Assault Recovery and Prevention Center. I left a few years later and went to the North County Women's Shelter because we have this thing in the county called the Grade, and things are very different up there. And so we had our own domestic violence shelter up there. A couple years into that, we did a merger between the SARP Center and the North County Women's Shelter, and we became RISE. So lots of people are really familiar with RISE. I took a little sabbatical in 2019, and in 2020, right after the pandemic started, I came back and worked at Stand Strong, which was previously known as the Women's Shelter Program. And in 2021, we merged RISE and Stand Strong to become Lumina Alliance. So if you kept track, I think there's like 7 or 8 different names in there. And so this is where we are now. And we're excited because all three of those organizations came together. And so now there's no confusion. There's one number to call. We have offices in South County, North County, and here in SLO, and provide services throughout the county.
That to me was probably the best part of all of this. Eliminate that confusion. You know, a lot of the things you're tackling kind of overlap. So for those who aren't familiar, Lumina Alliance was all of those things and is still doing that. So obviously there's so much important work that's going on at Lumina Alliance, but a lot of the service seems to have to be reactive to a situation. But I think one of the most important pieces is education, you know, with the hope that maybe through education we can break the cycle of violence that has been a forever problem in our society. Is your education focused on adults? Do you reach out to schools?
Yes, I always say, having done this work for 30 years, I could not do it if we weren't also out there trying to prevent it from happening in the first place. And our prevention education department has come a long way. And we actually are at a really exciting point because we are in some elementary schools right now utilizing a great program where we actually have parent educators talking to parents about how to have these conversations with children around respect and boundaries. And, you know, we're not getting in there and talking in depth about sexual assault and intimate partner violence, but we understand where the roots of those things start. And so working in the elementary schools has been amazing. We are also in some high schools. We go out and we do sex education, which is required by our state that all high school students receive that. So we provide that service. We're also talking about healthy relationships, what those look like, what they don't. With today's technology, kids can get really confused and think that stalking behavior is like love. And so we really want to help them understand the differences. And we also work with adults to say, you know, what's going on in our communities? How can we address these issues? How can you be involved and engaged with us to address this work? It's a community-wide problem. It's not an easy, simple fix and requires all of us to be at the table.
The idea of a healthy relationship, you know, that was not something when I was in school that was ever talked about. And if you've potentially only seen your parents' relationship mm-hmm. that isn't maybe a healthy relationship. Maybe that's all you know. And getting this education, that's so important. Again, respecting other people, social media being a constant bombardment of what are we seeing is okay and not okay. So I love that you guys are there helping young kids, high schoolers starting to learn, and again, really trying to break that cycle of violence.
Yeah, I think lots of people are aware that domestic violence, intimate partner violence can be, there can be a cycle of it that runs in families. And actually the same holds true for sexual assault, childhood sexual abuse. That also can be generational. These are things that we don't talk about. And so for kids, it's really challenging because oftentimes these are secrets that are happening at home and they have nowhere to go with it. So by helping parents learn to talk to their children so that their children can disclose if something's happening that shouldn't be, and for those teens to have a safe place to talk about these things as well.
Yeah. Hopefully at some point, if there isn't a safe place, they know there was a group that we could come and talk to.
Absolutely. And our services are available 24/7 with our crisis line, no charge. You know, we use a language line, so their services are available in all languages. And so we just want to be as accessible as possible. And they're confidential. When it gets to kids, there's some, you know, challenges there. But at 12 and up, in the state of California, they have a right to make these decisions and to get access to services on their own. So we provide that safe place for them.
Are most of your clients maybe referred through law enforcement or mm-hmm. hospital, or do you find that friends and family are referring? Is it kind of a mix of all of that?
It is a mix of all of it. So we work with all of our law enforcement partners throughout the county, all of our hospitals. They will call us and we will respond there. We will respond to police departments. People call on their own, and we have friends and family members who call for them. So it's unfortunately, we're one of those organizations that oftentimes people don't know about us until they need us. So, you know, we try to have a strong presence on social media, and our website is chock full of information. And that 24/7 crisis line is, and it's crisis and information. So we're available just to talk to people. They don't have to be in crisis. And we can also really support loved ones because it can be difficult to know what to say or what to do. And oftentimes we want to say we have to call the police, and that's not necessarily the right choice for all survivors. So we want to give them all the options because all their choices were taken away when they were harmed in these ways.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that's a hard part for a family member who may be seeing this and maybe the opportunity to call Lumina and say, how can I help? Or I can't get my brother, sister, whatever, to access this. If you're just joining us, I'm Jim D'Antona from the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and this is Working Lunch on KCBX. And we are here with Jenny Adams talking about the issues impacting our county. Jennifer Adams is the Chief Executive Officer for Lumina Alliance. So how many employees does Lumina Alliance have?
So right now we have 56 people, 46 FTE, you know, full-time equivalent. So we have some part-time people in there. But we are also covering 3 different offices, 3 different emergency shelters, and we have 2 transitional housing units in different towns. So we're doing a lot with a small but mighty group.
In a small community like ours, do you ever find it difficult to locate specialists to deliver these services?
You know, it's one of the reasons I love working in the nonprofit field. The people who work at Lumina Alliance are really drawn to the work. They're very passionate about it. We can have challenges bringing people in. You know, we've had several instances where people have applied and wanted to come from outside the area. And boy, that challenging with housing is rough, right? So that's definitely a thing. Also, you know, we're lean. We're a nonprofit. We talk about how, you know, it's not top wages that you're going to make doing this work. But we're super proud of the culture we have created, The work that our staff does is so hard. It's, you know, there's this thing called secondary trauma that people experience from hearing these stories. And so it's difficult work. So we really provide an environment that is supportive and caring and flexible. Our, you know, we're a family-friendly workplace, which goes a long way, I think, in helping to attract employees. You know, we have a great pet policy that allows our furry friends to be there, and clients love that when they come in and there's a dog that they can pet. Just trying to provide an environment that our staff needs so that they can do the difficult work of providing the services to clients.
The work is really hard. If you are in this line of work, you're in it because you care. So you've hit on those family-friendly workplaces. You know, you're pet-friendly. Do the family-friendly things you provide, do they trickle over into your clients? And
yeah, so we have babies in the office, and so, you know, we have space for childcare. We have a beautiful little childcare room. In fact, I was at a committee meeting last night for our event, which we'll talk about soon. But one of the committee members had their child with them, and so I was able to take them back there and get them set up and, you know, have them play with toys. Clients come into the office, they bring their children with them. We don't want the kids to be present while the parent is talking about the abuse or the assault. And so we're able to take them, you know, into this other room where they can feel safe and cared for while their parent gets the services that they need. So, yeah, you know, we're flexible with our staff so that they can attend things at kids' schools and work remotely if they've got a sick kid, or, you know, leave early if there's an event at school. So just really trying to advocate for that family first, because if we're worried about our families, you know, if they're not being taken care of, we're not able to really bring our best selves to work. And the skills that are being utilized at Lumina Alliance are all about being able to be present with somebody who's in trauma, in pain, and we have to be whole and healthy in order to do that.
So talk a little bit about Lumina Alliance's funding.
So we are a 501c3. We're a nonprofit. And so any support that you want to provide us is, you know, a tax deduction, if you can figure that piece out. So we are not a government entity, but we are greatly supported by government grants. And we normally, and I've been doing this for a long time, we've always been around 70% supported by grants, 30% by donations and events and, you know, community support. Right now, that number is a little bit higher than usual. The pandemic really changed things. It brought in a lot of additional funding. People had a lot of, you know, discretionary money that they were sending to us, which we were so appreciative. So we're making an adjustment right now. So we're about 80% supported by our grants right now, which is great, except when things happen. So one of the biggest challenges that we are dealing with right now, and it's actually the biggest challenge of my career, I've never seen anything like this. We're very largely supported by a fund called the Victims of Crime Act. It's federal dollars. It is a fund that is created by fines and penalties from federal cases. And so we think of tobacco, large tobacco and white collar crime. And, you know, so when those are prosecuted at the federal level, they pay into these funds. And those funds are distributed throughout the country to organizations like Lumina Alliance, as well as Victim Witness at the DA's office, CASA Voices for Children, our local child advocacy center that we're getting up and going. human trafficking services, Elder, SLOLAF, who does our legal services. So a multitude of agencies here locally will be impacted, as well as across the country. We're looking at a 30% cut to those funds, which is going to equal about a 15% cut to our overall budget, anywhere between $500,000 and $800,000. And that is a chunk of money for us.
So that sounds like it's coming right from federal prosecution, as potentially we're doing less of it on true crimes. It's not like this is a tax or something. These are true crimes. And because we're not prosecuting, those fines aren't being accumulated. That's actually impacting our local nonprofits dealing with victims of crime.
It's wild, right? Wow. It's wild. Yeah. Over the last decade or so, a little bit less than that, there has been the drop off in that, and it has caused this fund to really drop precipitously. And we will see domestic violence shelters, rape crisis centers in the state of California go under if these cuts actually take place on July 1st. And the part of the budget that the federal government is dealing with right now includes these cuts, and they have not backfilled them. So we are going to have to start advocating at the state level, which we've already started. Representative Addis is already a co-signer on a bill that would help backfill some of these funds. So we're appreciative of that. But now we're going to have to look at the state of California, which is also facing a budget deficit. So it's pretty scary for us right now. And we've already started not hiring positions in preparation for these cuts.
Listeners, that is something you can do to reinforce with our Congress members, certainly Panetta and Carbajal, to try and make sure we're staying on top of these and prosecuting those that deserve to be prosecuted, because that's actually creating funds that protect our community. So then I guess the other way then to backfill is potentially donors, which take a lot to do. But you just recently started a fundraiser called Dancing with Our Stars. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It's super exciting. So this was, for any listeners that may have attended in Atascadero, this was an event that was started about 12 years ago to raise funds for their library, for a new library in Atascadero. And I actually live in Atascadero, and we have a beautiful new library because of this event. Really, they work so hard. We asked local stars, well-known members in the community, to work with a choreographer, learn a dance, and then come and perform at this event. Atascadero raised all their money, built the library. Then they started doing the event and allowing nonprofits to raise money, which I did. I was a star. It's been, I don't know, 2017, I think. And it was super fun, a really great event. And so when they decided that they were going to actually stop doing it, we worked together to take that over. So Lumina Nights will be happening April 12th and 13th at Thousand Hills Ranch. And we will be featuring six stars. Jim, anything you want to share?
I may be. I appreciate the loose definition of star and dancer, but I will be performing. Again, such a huge supporter of this. I am more than willing to fall flat on my face on this to make sure we're funding the great work you're doing. But yeah, it's super exciting. Such a fun way for people that are able to donate, see their friends, come see if we can dance, but really, truly to support this great organization and the money you raise, because again, it's going to backfill to do some of these things that are likely coming down the pike. So where can they find out about
yes,
it?
Yes, tickets are going fast. In fact, I didn't check this morning, but we're very close to selling out Saturday night. So go to luminaalliance.org or Lumina Nights 2024. You can buy tickets to the event. You can support any of the dancers.
I've had a blast doing it. And it, again, really great to know that we're raising funds for the important work you're doing. So if folks need Lumina services or know someone who would benefit from the amazing service you do, what's the best way for them to learn about that, what Lumina can provide?
So there are several ways. LumenAlliance.org, the website, is chock full of information, even to help people know what to say to a survivor that discloses that something happened to them. You're always welcome to call and talk to someone on the 24-hour crisis and information line. It is information as well. So that's 805-545-8888. There's tons of ways to get involved, attending our events, supporting our dancers. We have an emergency fund set up specifically because of these VOCA cuts. You can get information about that on the website. We have a board of directors. We have that 24-hour crisis line is staffed by volunteers. We have a care program where people can be trained that they can do that and provide those services. So tons of ways to get involved, and we're always happy to talk with anybody about what that might look like.
I want to thank Jenny for joining us today. To our listeners, thank you for joining us for this important conversation. On behalf of Jennifer Adams of Lumina Alliance, KCBX, and I'm Jim D'Antona for the Slo Chamber of Commerce, we hope you have an amazing week. Keep making our community a wonderful place to live.
This is KCBX Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Carol Tangeman. A new effort is underway to save some of the oldest and largest living things on the planet. Giant sequoia trees generally live more than 2,000 years, but about a fifth of their numbers have been killed recently by extreme wildfires. The National Park Service here in California wants to bring them back in a way that is cause for debate. Lauren Summer of NPR's Climate Desk takes us to Sequoia National Park.
Giant sequoias are meant to survive wildfires. In fact, they depend on them.
You can see this one has a fire scar at the base, a black triangle.
Christy Brigham is chief of resources management and science at Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Back in October, we were looking up at one of the park's giant sequoia trees, one that's still alive.
It's spectacular, right? You can see why people love them. Super quirky. It's got this funky broccoli top. It gives you this feeling that it's old.
This one is old. It's been growing here for more than 1,000 years. Its massive trunk is protected from fires by this rough, thick bark.
Crazy thick, 12 to 18 inches thick.
So when the KNP complex fire burned through here in 2021, this tree survived. And it did more than that. Below it, the forest floor is covered in tiny, fuzzy seedlings.
Those are all sequoia seedlings. Yeah, it's awesome.
Sequoias need fire to reproduce. The heat opens up their cones, showering the forest floor with thousands of seeds that sprout in the cleared out soil.
And lots of bad things are going to happen to these. Another fire, fire after fire before they get that big. So they make a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot.
This carpet of baby trees is exactly what Brigham wants to see after a fire. Further down the trail, though, it's a different story.
We have now arrived at the location that we call the Gates of Mordor.
There are big trees in this part of the park, some 1,500 years old, but they're blackened all the way to the top.
Dead, 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 dead. This one's dead.
This is where the fire became an inferno.
It was horrible, and I don't think I've cried so much in my entire life.
The forest here was primed to burn. Historically, it had regular fires, low-grade ones that cleared out the forest floor. Those were started by lightning and Native American tribes who managed the land with controlled burns. But when European settlers came, people started putting out fires.
We have put out more than 90 lightning strikes in this area in the 100 years that we've been managing.
Without those fires, a lot of dead vegetation built up. That includes smaller trees killed in California's recent droughts, made worse by climate change. Over two summers, extreme fires killed as many as 14,000 sequoias. It shocked ecologists like Brigham.
We had never seen anything like this in giant sequoia. Large giant sequoias before now survived wildfire.
And in spots like this one, there's another concern.
So we're looking for the little lime green giant sequoia seedlings. And we don't see any.
There's very few seedlings here, that next generation of forest. And there are a few living trees to produce more. So the Park Service is trying a bold experiment. A line of mules is winding its way through the burned area with special cargo on their backs.
So there they are.
That's the sequoias right there.
Yep.
They're bags of sequoia seedlings that are about to be planted.
Josiah, how'd you feel about this spot?
Micah Craig is here with a team from the Eastern Sierra Conservation Corps. He digs a small hole and tucks the 4-inch seedling into the dirt.
Planting sequoias, I mean, that's like a legacy thing, something that we are all stoked to do that will, you know, transcend after us.
But this tiny seedling will grow up in a world that's changing. Temperatures are getting hotter, which threatens these trees. So the Park Service is trying to plan for that. While most of these seedlings come from seeds from this exact grove, 20% are from nearby sequoia groves that are lower in elevation and already seeing hotter conditions.
There may actually be some genes or adaptations in those populations to hotter, drier conditions.
The idea is to increase the genetic diversity of this grove by bringing in seedlings that would never get here otherwise.
We have the ability to give this grove a little bit of a bigger toolkit for adapting to changing conditions, and that's what we're trying to do. We're asking a lot of these trees to survive for 400 years, 1,000 years, and they can do it, but let's give them a little help.
But not everyone agrees sequoias need the help.
We need to allow nature some places where human beings aren't trying to be the managers, aren't trying to be the gardeners.
George Nickus is executive director of Wilderness Watch, a nonprofit group focused on wilderness protection. His group has sued to stop the sequoia replanting project since it's happening in a designated wilderness area. Nickus says even with the human impacts on sequoia trees, like climate change and putting out fires, wilderness areas shouldn't be touched.
Because we're the ones that messed it up, it doesn't flow that we're the ones to fix it. That's that sort of arrogance of humanism, if you will. That's when we need to learn to step back.
Scientific studies show that sequoia seedlings die in high numbers when they're young. But Nickus says there's a chance sequoias could come back on their own.
But if they don't, or they don't come back exactly the way we would prefer, the Park Service might prefer, whatever, that's the way it is in nature.
The National Park Service doesn't talk about pending lawsuits, but in public comments has said that wilderness protections still allow the agency to do preservation work.
We are supposed to preserve wilderness character, and part of the wilderness character of this place is giant sequoias.
This is a debate that's happening on public lands all over. Humans are drastically changing the planet, so how much should we intervene to try to fix it? Brigham says sequoia trees, as some of the biggest and longest living things on the planet, force that conversation.
You cannot look at them without thinking about 1,000 years in the future. They demand better of us, and I think we need that. We need those species that are being impacted by climate change that we love to be like, hey, I think you can do better.
A judge will hear the lawsuit against the sequoia replanting project later this spring. Lauren Sommer, NPR News.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.